Moss Cohen, welcome back to Radio Times. For years, cereal was the top choice for breakfast in this country. Today, Americans are increasingly choosing breakfast bars and yogurt instead of Cheerios, Wheat Chex, and Frosted Flakes. Coming up, we'll talk about why that reliable traditional bowl of cereal has fallen out of favor. We'll also get a short history of breakfast in the United States from colonial times to today. But first, is breakfast the most important meal of the day? And what are health implications of skipping breakfast or loading up on a sugar or calorie-rich meal? In other words, what's the best thing to eat in the morning? We asked Eric Rim to join us. He's a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School, also a professor of epidemiology and nutrition and director of the program in cardiovascular epidemiology at Harvard School of Public Health. A mouthful. Eric Rim, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. So how important is it to eat at breakfast?
You'd think that we would know the exact answer to that. You would think. And it has been studied a lot, but there's been, you know, a lot of sort of small studies and sort of people trying to do something fun in 100 people. So, you know, it is something that we probably do need a lot more research on, but there have now been a few really large studies that have followed people for 20 years. We've done some of these. And you try to account for the fact that maybe people who skip breakfast have a more stressful life or are rushing around or don't get to exercise as much. But what we did find is that people who skip breakfast really were at higher risk of gaining weight and higher risk of having a heart attack later in life. So it wasn't a really strong association. It's not like smoking or, you know, not exercising, but it was a positive association. And some of the heart disease risk we could explain by the fact that people were more likely to gain weight who skipped breakfast.
And why is it? Is it they are so hungry by the time lunch rolls around that they're overeating?
I think that it's probably a number of factors, and we don't know the specifics of it. And, you know, we had a study of 27,000 people, but we don't know the specifics of what they ate at every meal. We kind of know about their average diet. And I think some of it is that traditionally a breakfast can be a time when people generally can choose healthier foods. You can get foods that are higher in fiber, or people have fruit, or as you mentioned, you know, people have yogurt. So it is a meal where people can have healthier nutrition intake. So that could be part of it. And the other part is, as you mentioned, that people still get their calories, which means they're getting more of their calories from their lunch and from their dinner. So your body has to handle the fact that there's a bolus of calories coming twice a day, as opposed to spreading the calories out over the full day and not having the same ebb and flow of your glucose and of lipids in your bloodstream.
And do you think that explains the higher risk for heart attack?
Yeah, I think that's part of it. I mean, there have been smaller studies that have looked at what happens if you skip breakfast over a shorter period of time. And you know, if you look at the extremes of sort of having all your food at lunch versus having it three meals a day, you do see people that have all their food at one meal do have worse cholesterol levels and also are not as able to adequately handle glucose in their bloodstream.
I mean, it is possible to eat a bowl of Count Chocula for breakfast, or, I mean, it is possible to eat really bad or very calorie-rich food for breakfast, it seems.
Yeah, I think, sure, traditionally, I mean, people go have breakfast at a fast food restaurant. You can have, you know, three eggs and fried potatoes and have a, you know, not very good breakfast at all. So I think that's something that we have to remember. Instead of just saying, I skip breakfast or I eat breakfast, it really needs to be the quality of the breakfast. And so I would much prefer to talk about the quality of individual's diet over the course of the day rather than just saying, you know, eat a meal or don't eat a meal. So I do think that you should eat breakfast, but I don't think it should be Count Chocula. I think it should be a healthier breakfast that, you know, allows you to get adequate calories and adequate fiber.
So what did you have for breakfast today?
This morning, I actually had yogurt and blueberries with a little bit of grain sprinkled on them.
Is it hard, though, to, I mean, we're going to spend the whole hour talking about breakfast. You're the first of three guests, but is it hard to talk to study breakfast? Because you can see, I guess, some association between eating breakfast or not eating breakfast and some health conditions, but it's hard sometimes to figure out whether there's cause and effect there.
Yeah, that's I think that's where the field is. I mean, if you think about a new drug that people take for, let's say, high cholesterol, you do a randomized trial where you give half the people the drug and half the people the placebo, and you follow them for 5 years, and 5 years later, you see who has the most heart attacks. And there's been studies like that with breakfast, but it's really hard to randomize people not to eat breakfast for a very long period of time. So there have been studies that have gone 3 or 4 months, but that's probably not long enough to look at risk of heart attack, and it's not even long enough to look at weight change, because weight change is really complicated. So it's a hard scientific field to study. So what we've relied on are these really large observational studies where people just tell you what they do. And so it is hard to say, well, that's truly causal, and it's not just because, you know, all the other reasons that people skip breakfast. It's because these are intense, stressed people that have to get to work and things like that. So, you know, all you can do is try to look at all of the evidence together and say, if you take the small, short-term randomized trials and combine it with the big observational studies, sort of what does the totality of evidence tell you? And it does tell you, on average, people who eat breakfast do better. It's going to be hard to prove that, like we do for drugs or for other things that you can study for 5 or 10 years in a randomized fashion.
Is that because people either don't tell the truth, or they can't remember, or they don't know, or they're not aware of the things that they're eating anyway?
No, I think people do tell the truth. I mean, that's one of those things. I mean, the questions that we ask sort of, do you regularly eat, you know, breakfast, lunch, dinner, eat after dinner, eat before you go to bed at night? And, you know, there's no reason that people would not tell the truth. And people do have sort of general patterns that, you know, there's probably some mistakes made in the middle, but at the tails where you say this person skipped breakfast every day and this person eat breakfast every day, there's probably pretty good recall there. And that's where we do the comparisons, and that's where you see big differences. And I think, you know, breakfast is one meal. I know that's what you're talking about today.
Yep.
But in our study of eating patterns, people who ate late at night actually did the worst. People are sort of those late-night eaters that get up after they go to sleep or eat a lot right before they go to sleep. They had twice the risk of a heart attack compared to someone who skips breakfast. So, you know, that's why I think you need to take the general eating pattern, the whole eating pattern, not just do you have a healthy breakfast, but look at other times that you eat during the day and what you eat when you do eat.
I ran across some headlines in preparation for the show. One says skipping breakfast can lead to weight gain. The other one says skipping breakfast may not be bad for weight loss after all. And I think for the public, if you're going to pay attention to this stuff, and perhaps it's misleading headlines, sometimes it's hard to know what to do because it seems like there's contradictory information.
Yeah, I think the first thing is headlines are to get you to read the article. They're not written by the scientists. And, you know, I think within the scientific field, there's not 100% agreement. But the point is that the headline that you just read about skipping breakfast is not related to weight gain. You know, that was a 3.5-month study where people were trying to lose weight. They were overweight to begin with. And they randomized them to skipping breakfast or not skipping breakfast. And there was really no difference after 3 months. But that's not long enough time period to follow. I mean, no other dietary program that we've ever looked at ever says 3 months is enough time to look at weight loss. Because there's lots of things that work or don't work in the short term that in the long term are really good for you. So your body takes a while to metabolically adjust. If you're 100 pounds overweight and you change something over a week or a month or 2 months, that can have very different effects than sort of keeping with a program for 2 years or 3 years or 4 years. So that's why there's confusion, is because it's hard to say there's one right way to test this.
But could you say that eating breakfast could help someone to lose weight? And I realize we're talking in really broad strokes here, but or perhaps even prevent weight gain because they might be more careful about what they eat. They're less ravenous at certain times of the day.
Yes, and I think that's exactly one of the hypotheses that we have going into this, is that, you know, to spread your calories out over the day, but be attentive to what you're eating. Do not have, you know, poor quality breakfast. If that's what you're going to do, I would say avoid the breakfast. Because I do think there's a lot of bad snacking and bad eating that goes on during the day because people have poor eating at breakfast. If you have a highly processed grain or highly processed cereal at breakfast, you're going to be hungry 2 hours later. You know, it doesn't really make a difference that you had a breakfast. You're going to be hungry 2 hours later because that's how your glucose and insulin works in your body. So, you know, I think pay attention to the quality, and I think it's important to spread those calories out over the day and not just have a ravenous lunch or ravenous dinner because you skipped meals previously.
It's so interesting when you go to another country. I've gone to, you know, Eastern European countries, and what they have for breakfast is, you know, cheeses and meats and fruits and yogurts. I think this country is moving more in that direction, but then nonetheless, it's a different kind of way to start the day.
Yeah, and it is amazing, isn't it? The variability you can see from Eastern Europe to the U.S.
Yes.
to Africa to China. I mean, what people eat and eating patterns are so different. And some of that evolved, I think, because of great commercials by the industry or, you know, great just sort of cultural shifts. And I'm sure some of the breakfast eating went on because of great advertising in the 50s and 60s and 70s. And some of that was great. You know, they're high whole grain cereals. That's fantastic. Then let's eat it. And, you know, other times, you know, it's been just trends of what people liked. But I do think it does move. It does. Clearly, there's been a change in yogurts and Greek yogurts that are consumed in this country versus 10 or 15 years ago.
Yeah, and we're going to be talking about that. But do you think we have sort of an eating disordered view of eating in this country?
I think there's a lot of people that know what a good quality diet is and are able to eat. But I do think that, I mean, it's a whole separate topic, but there's so much that comes in front of our eyes, either from television or from computer screens, about what to eat and when to eat and, you know, how happy it makes you feel, that I do think it is a pretty dysfunctional system, because there's a lot of really poor quality foods that companies spend billions of dollars in advertising. So I do think that we have an unhealthy relationship with food that could be improved substantially and really would help the health of the nation.
We've focused a lot on breakfast for children and making sure that children going to school are not going to school hungry. I'm assuming, Eric Rim, about a minute before I have to say goodbye, is that we need to make sure that the growing and learning children get that early morning breakfast.
Yeah, it's something we're starting to study, brain function in children related to their quality of their breakfast in the morning. I think it's so important that it's a good quality breakfast so they don't all need a snack at 10 o'clock. I think we're almost overfeeding our children by kind of having the snack time at 10 o'clock and 2 o'clock. You know, in general, I don't think kids need that much energy. I think if it's a good quality breakfast, they'll be able to last until lunchtime. And it will help them think better and perform better in schools and act better, just to sort of how they act with their socially, they'll act better if that's a healthier breakfast.
Well, on that note, Eric Rim, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times, getting our conversation started.
Great. My pleasure.
You're welcome. And he's a professor.
Take care.
You too. He's a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School, also a professor of epidemiology and nutrition, and the director of the program in cardiovascular epidemiology, also at Harvard School of Public Health. And we have Matthew Hudak waiting in the wings. We'll be talking about why cereal has been or is being replaced by yogurt. Stay with us. We'll be right back as we continue our conversation talking about, yes, indeed, breakfast on Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY Xfinity from Comcast, presenting the X1 Entertainment Operating System, where customers can access all of their entertainment on all of their screens. With the X1, DVR customers can watch recordings from any room in the house. X1 from Comcast.
Next time in Studio 360, musician Andrew Bird shares the secret to his success: not thinking positively.
I do kind of, before a tour starts, imagine the worst happening, which is the bus going off a cliff.
Also, a live performance from Andrew Bird and his band next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Way back when, New York City was known for its oysters.
And the average New Yorker, as recently as 1920, ate 600 local New York City oysters a year. Now they eat zero.
We'll talk seafood sustainability with Paul Greenberg next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Support for WHYY comes from the new Wells Fargo Propel World American Express card, designed to bring the world within reach for Wells Fargo customers. Details at a local Philadelphia area branch or wellsfargo.com/propel. Wells Fargo, the world is open. Keep exploring.
What's this stuff? Some cereal. It's supposed to be good for you. I'm not going to try it.
Let's get Mikey.
Yeah. He won't eat it. He hates everything.
He likes it. Hey, Mikey.
Regular, cinnamon, and Raisin Life. Nutritious, delicious.
That's the famous Mikey commercial for Life cereal when cereals were a popular breakfast food. Not so true anymore. And joining us now is Matthew Hudak, and he's a research analyst for Euromonitor International. Matthew Hudak, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
So why are Americans turning against cereal for breakfast?
Well, basically, it seems like it is the least efficient option for the morning. Right now, there are a lot of other things they could choose from, whether it be food service options. Obviously, lots of places are introducing new food service varieties. Taco Bell had their recent launch of that waffle burrito taco. And on top of that, there's other options like breakfast bars that are, you know, pretty healthy, like Kind bars or something that might have more energy, like a Clif bar. And then finally, yogurt. Greek yogurts are doing incredibly well now, including, you know, Chobani or Danone or things like that.
So is it efficiency? Is that what Americans want in the morning? They don't want to sit down at their breakfast table and have a bowl of cereal? They want to get out the door?
Well, that's definitely a big part of it. You know, obviously you need a bowl of cereal and you need milk to actually enjoy a bowl of cereal, but, you know, with a breakfast bar, like you just take it on the go, leave it at work, leave it, you know, wherever you want to and eat it at your leisure. And then, you know, yogurt, again, you don't need a bowl, so it does eliminate that. On top of that, obviously, there's been cold weather in the U.S. as of late, and typically cereals are a little bit hurt by cold weather, the ready-to-eat ones. But hot cereals tend to, you know, fill that gap some. And so that's been another factor that's been driving things down.
I wonder, too, whether that, and perhaps it's still even with us now, the anti-carb era when cereals, and if you look on the box, you know, loaded with sugar, all sorts of unpronounceable additives, vitamins, whether Americans decided, you know, just too much carb in my diet, I'm going to take cereal out of my diet.
Well, that's definitely a factor in it, and it's not just carbs. Obviously, a big factor that's affecting a lot of cereals is the fact that many of them contain gluten. And obviously, the gluten-free diet is still going on. There's a lot of consumers out there who are adopting it, not because they have celiac. Actually, you know, quite few actually have celiac disease. Many of them are simply non-celiac but feel like they're gluten-sensitive. So they just simply feel more energetic. They think they feel better if they give up gluten. And, you know, once they believe that this is happening, whether or not there is a medical reason, sometimes there is, sometimes there isn't, they're not going to go back. And then on top of that, there are people who are adopting the gluten-free diet just for the dietary aspect because they think they'll lose weight.
How about cereals for snack food? Are you seeing that?
I'm sorry?
Cereals for snacks?
Well, again, there's still a lot of other snacks out there to compete with. Obviously, there are breakfast bars that can be, Kind bars can be eaten as snacks. And then, you know, the snack industry itself is always pretty competitive. You know, Lay's will always bring out something. The ready-to-eat popcorns, which are really low in calories, like Skinny Pop, those are doing incredibly well. So, you know, because there are already, you know, a lot of established players there, that's very hard to jump into.
So when did Greek yogurt take over the dairy aisle?
That would be, you know, I think somewhere around 2007, around the time where Chobani really started to take off, maybe a little bit after that. And, you know, once it got, you know, introduced, specifically the Chobani brand, you know, every other big yogurt player eventually jumped on. Danone followed not too far after with their own line that obviously has had some Super Bowl commercials in the past few years, and it's really just something where consumers think because this product has, you know, higher protein, it also has a kind of a thicker, nicer texture. They believe that, you know, it's satiating them better. It's giving them more energy in the day. That's a pretty big part of it.
And that's certainly part of the marketing as well. Yes.
Oh yeah, definitely. They really like to hit on that. You know, this is something that can really fuel you throughout the day.
I know from some of these yogurts, when they add the fruit, they also are just loading it up with sugar as well. I'm not sure how much that's part of the promotion of some of these yogurts, but I think it's people should be aware of that.
Yeah, obviously, many of these products will typically contain quite a bit of sugar. Even the snack bars, there are quite a few that are genuinely pretty low in sugar. So it's something where, obviously, on that point, cereals and a lot of the things that are replacing them tend to actually be, more equivalent than you would think. But still, the other added factors, obviously, the protein and the lack of gluten are tipping things away from cereal's favor.
There was a report recently saying, looking at some of these cereals, saying that the vitamins really were adult portions of vitamins, and I guess raising some concerns about children eating cereal. Have you looked at that, Matthew?
I mean, it's something, that I've looked at before, and obviously, parents are keeping a very close watch on what they're feeding their kids more and more. So they want to make sure they're giving them the right nutritional content per day, and it's very hard with cereals, especially considering the cereals that kids want tend to be the cereals you definitely don't want to feed them. Your high sugar cereals with a cartoon on the box.
Yes, we know exactly what you're talking about. So, what did you have for breakfast today, Matthew?
I had a snack bar.
You had a snack bar.
Yeah.
Is that generally how you begin the day?
Typically, that or just a piece of fruit or something light, and if I'm feeling, incredibly hungry, I normally just go to a nearby, Potbellies or something to get a breakfast sandwich.
And what I hear is just in terms of how Americans are looking at breakfast these days is that they have busy mornings and they want to get out the door, and perhaps something on the go is the most efficient way to get some of those calories. Do I have it right there?
Yeah, absolutely. They do not want to have to sit down and have a meal in the morning. They'd like to just get on with their day and have something that they can easily get a hold of. It doesn't take them that long, and they can eat it wherever they need to.
And how different are people's breakfast when it comes to the weekends?
When it comes to the weekends, again, since they're already purchasing a lot of these breakfast bars or yogurts, or they're buying them in bulk, there's doesn't seem to be a reason to just buy cereals just for the weekend. So they just, continue that as well. Better they sleep through breakfast sometimes.
Right, exactly. Well, Matthew Hudak, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
No, thanks again for having me.
You're very welcome. He's a research analyst for Euromonitor International, the second of three guests in this hour of Radio Times. We're talking about Americans and what they eat for breakfast, and we want to hear from you. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. And do I eat breakfast during the week? No, I do not, but I do eat it on the weekend. So, joining us now is Abigail Carroll, and she's a food historian, author of a book called Three Squares, The Invention of the American Meal. And Abigail Carroll, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much, Marty.
So what did you have for breakfast today?
Well, I had actually a very unconventional breakfast by necessity, more than choice, because of my number of food allergies. I had some sautéed turkey and Swiss chard and tomatoes and avocados and olive oil. So I cooked my breakfast this morning.
Well, how un-American of you, apparently. Well, let's go back to the beginning, which is where your book begins, looking at at colonial days in America. And obviously, depending on where you lived at that time, probably a different breakfast. But what would be the typical 17th century breakfast in colonial America?
Well, a typical breakfast did not consist of what we would call breakfast food. There really wasn't such a thing as breakfast food. People ate the same kinds of foods for breakfast, dinner, and supper. And so breakfast might often be leftovers from dinner, which was actually the midday meal, the main meal, and sometimes the only hot meal. And so if you cooked a lot of food for dinner on the hearth in the middle of the day, you might have leftovers for supper, and then you might have more leftovers for breakfast. But if you didn't have leftovers, a good go-to was cornmeal mush or some kind of a stewed grain, maybe even a stewed like peas porridge. Mm-hmm. You could put molasses on that cornmeal mush, some milk. You might have just some bread. And, there was a convenience factor there. You didn't necessarily want to get up and cook first thing in the morning, especially if you had leftovers or if you had a pie that you could slice a piece off of.
You find, and it would make sense that there were regional differences. You also write about Scrapple and Pennsylvania,
sure.
Especially yeah. Philadelphia. Is there a short history of Scrapple you could share with us?
Well, Scrapple does originate from Butchering Day, and it's a way to use the more perishable parts of pork in particular. It sort of mixes the various edible organs and offal with grain, some cornmeal and whatnot, and was particularly popular and common in Philadelphia in particular, but also just in Pennsylvania, and was common at breakfast, as was buckwheat pancakes. Peter Kalm, who was a Swedish traveler in 1750, wrote that in the wintertime, buckwheat cakes, which meant buckwheat pancakes, were perhaps the most popular breakfast. And at that point, pancakes were not necessarily a breakfast food, but they had become a breakfast food there. And it was seasonal. Buckwheat was not something that you made pancakes with in the summertime.
You have a quote from a gentleman or a British traveler named Thomas Holm. He's passing through Kentucky and Illinois in the early 19th century, and he ate bacon, beef, eggs, honey bread with tea, and coffee for breakfast, and remarked with regard to the food, I never liked my living in England more than I do here. He loved the American breakfast.
Yes, yes. Well, there were two reactions to it. I mean, people either loved it or they hated it because it was too heavy. What had happened, breakfast changes over time. And in fact, if you look at breakfast, dinner, and supper, they all change over time. But I think breakfast changes more than the other two meals. And so it starts off, like I said, being sometimes just a very ad hoc, cold, informal, snack-like stopgap between the other meals. But when farmers are beginning to flourish in the 1700s especially, and then into the early 1800s, and people have a little bit more prosperity, they're not on survival mode like they are in the 1600s. They can afford more meat. They have more meat. Meat shows up as central to dinner, and then it shows up also as central to breakfast. It's very central. And often there were multiple meats at our breakfast, especially in taverns, but sometimes also in homes. And those meats varied. Like, you might have scrapple in Philadelphia. You might have ham in Virginia. Mm. You might have beefsteak in Pennsylvania, German country. You might have fish or fish balls, oysters, all sorts of fish on the coast. And so what happens is breakfast during that time of moderate prosperity becomes a second dinner. In fact, travelers remark that breakfast and dinner don't have anything to distinguish them except wine is served at one and not at the other.
And when did coffee or tea make its appearance? Or was that always part of breakfast?
Well, that came quite early in the very late 1600s, you start seeing that, but it's first enjoyed as actually as a medicinal. It was sold by apothecaries, as was chocolate, and then by wealthier people who could afford not only the coffee and tea itself, but the equipage, the teacups and saucers and spoons and, you know, all of the parts. And the tea ritual, the afternoon tea ritual, becomes popular among sort of the middling, but especially the little bit more wealthy people in the late 1700s and the 1800s. But, it has caffeine in it, and so it does the job. And so you see it associated with breakfast right from the 1700s.
We're sort of marching through history here. By, you say, the mid-19th century, we've got breakfast cakes, we've got pancakes, waffles, donuts, French toast, which you said really is really German.
Well, it's not necessarily French, although it was enjoyed in France, and there is the, pain perdu, the French term which you still encounter in Louisiana. But the truth is that people took stale pieces of bread and reconstituted them by soaking them in eggs or eggs in milk and, you know, some spices, and frying it up as a griddle cake. And that was a very thrifty thing to do. But it was also enjoyable because these were rich foods, especially if you put a little bit of sugar on top. And so you find that wealthier people were enjoying French toast as well. And we ended up calling it French toast. I'm not actually sure the story behind why French, but I mean, until fairly recently, it could be called a number of names, including German toast.
Ah. And, of course, beignets, which you can eat in New Orleans, a cousin or, I guess, a relative of donuts, which have become very, very popular.
Yes. There are all sorts of donut traditions, and the sort of ring donut that we have, you know, really is the reduction of many of those traditions. The beignets, the Fastnachts, and then the donut that we think of as a donut comes from the Dutch, and originally was not a ring. It was usually just a little ball, and then cookbooks in the 19th century suggest different ways to make donuts, different shapes such as diamonds or strips. And if you were going to make your own donuts and you wanted that ring shape, you would do that by taking two glasses of different sizes and stamping them into your dough to form two concentric circles, and that's how you made the ring. But then the ring became standard with the patenting of mechanical donut makers.
Again, marching through history here, and one can imagine with farm work or factory work, you need a lot of protein, you need a big breakfast, but then, you know, workers go to work and they sit at a desk all day, and you got problems, including, it seems like, a lot of indigestion at the end
of the 19th century. That's right. That was a big problem, and they called it dyspepsia. And there was a lot of rhetoric around the middle of the 19th century of what to do about it. People had all sorts of ideas about changing diet, basically because, you know, people were moving from farms to factories and many to desks, and yet they hadn't changed their diet to accommodate that. And so a lot of rhetoric does surface around breakfast and what one should or shouldn't eat for breakfast. And some of that rhetoric is just simply, you know, well, if you're eating four pancakes, just eat two. Or don't actually fry that leftover meat in lard. You know, and so some of the advice is just to reduce what they were already eating. But then a new kind of advice surfaces with health reformers like William Andrus Alcott, who was a relative of Louisa May Alcott, and Sylvester Graham, who's famous for the graham cracker. And these health reformers were saying, actually, no, if you want to feel better, you need to stop eating meat. These were vegetarians, right. And they believed that vegetarianism was biblical. They saw that Adam and Eve didn't eat meat in the Garden of Eden, and they, you know, really believed that that would renew society if people gave up meat, if they also gave up things like coffee and spices. And they suggested also unbolted flour. And Sylvester Graham, who was a failed itinerant preacher, sort of moved on from preaching the gospel to preaching the virtues of unbolted flour, which basically was bran. He advocated keeping the bran in the bread, which commercial bakers were no longer doing.
Well, let's take a very short break, and we'll pick up on that. We are talking or getting a history of the American breakfast, and that's Abigail Carroll. She's our guest. She's a food historian, author of a book called Three Squares, The Invention of the American Meal. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, open up the lines for your phone calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Much more about the American breakfast. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hi there, I'm Gian Gomeshi, the host of Q. Tune into Q each day for your dose of arts, culture, and entertainment, from live music and feature chats with compelling cultural figures to debates on the issues of the day. Q has got you covered. That's coming up from PRI, Public Radio International. Weeknights at 9, beginning August 4th on WHYY.
To survive her husband's 8 deployments, 4 to Iraq and Afghanistan, Angela Ricketts developed what some military spouses call the black soul, a soul that's become increasingly detached and hardened from goodbyes. During his deployments, she was home raising their 3 children. On the next Fresh Air, Ricketts talks about her new memoir describing life as an infantry wife. Join us.
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Talking the talk or keeping the faith.
We got Obama, and it's wonderful, but it is not going to address the structural problems that exist in the black community, which he has done practically nothing.
Symbolism versus action in President Obama's approach to race. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. If you're just joining us, Abigail Carroll is our guest. We are getting a history of the American breakfast, part of her book called Three Squares, The Invention of the American Meal. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. I do want to talk about cereal, but I also, before we do that, just want to read another quote from your book. And this is from a doctor who was taking care of a gentleman and found out that this man for breakfast, his breakfast included two large potatoes, two pieces of steak, two slices of bread, or from 4 to 6 hot pancakes, or 2 to 4 hot biscuits, all of these eaten with butter, honey, or molasses, not too large in amounts to be mentioned. That's an enormous breakfast.
It sure is. I think that would do me in.
It would do me in as well. I mean, do you think that was typical, or was this just a man with enormous appetite?
Well, that does sound particularly large, but it was typical to have a variety of pretty greasy foods, like I said, griddle cakes, meat, sometimes more than one kind of meat. Timothy Dwight in the 1820s said, breakfast without meat is considered scarcely worth eating.
Wow.
People were eating meat 2 to 3 times a day, and that goes for not just the elites, but a really broad swath of Americans.
But what's so interesting, you gave us some highlights of the introduction of breakfast cereal, which has a kind of ascetic feel to it. The idea is people shouldn't eat meat, and this should be a meal, a holy, I guess, for just health reasons. Why do you think cereal caught on?
Well, it caught on for a variety of reasons. First of all, people really were suffering, and so they were actively searching out panaceas, really, and gram flour, which eventually becomes used in breakfast cereal, becomes a panacea. And then it's also, I think, resonates with Americans because of the advertising that goes behind that, especially the work of Charles C. Post, who invented Grape Nuts and who really transformed advertising in America in general. But, of course, cereal in particular benefited from that. But I think people were going to sanitariums in the 1850s and 60s, and these were kind of like health spas where, you know, you get fresh air, you get some good water, you do some exercises, and you basically eat a diet of multiple kinds of foods made out of whole wheat or gram flour. And so the people who ran these sanitariums, you know, they were serving a very bland diet, and that was part of it. But they realized that if the next sanitarium, you know, was serving something a little bit more interesting, they were likely to lose their patronage. And so they were competing with, you know, different kinds of products. And James Caleb Jackson in Danville, New York, takes some of that gram flour. He mixes it with water. He bakes it. He takes that out, breaks it up, bakes it again, and comes up with these little nuggets, which he calls granula. And that is short for little grain. And that is the first breakfast cereal. And it's so hard, you cannot eat it without soaking it. And so you soak it in water or you soak it in milk. And in fact, it was traditional then to soak it overnight because that's how much soaking was needed. And people didn't have great teeth back then. And so actually there was a need for more mushy food and people were used to eating cornmeal mush. And so cereal was a different version, really, of cornmeal mush.
Well, as you said, people were suffering, and by that you mean they had indigestion or they had dyspepsia.
Yes.
I mean, they just felt sick, I'm assuming, a lot of the time because of this very fatty diet that they had.
Sure, yes.
And when did then milk come into play?
Well, milk does show up with the first iterations of breakfast cereal in the 1860s. But, of course, there's some suspicion surrounding milk. People are not drinking glasses of milk like they would in the 1950s because, well, it wasn't pasteurized, and there was all sorts of liabilities surrounding milk. And so it was much safer, actually, to make cheese out of it. It was very perishable. It was also susceptible to disease. And tuberculosis, which was a big, big killer around the turn of the century, was often spread through milk, through tuberculosis-infected cows or through dairymen that were themselves infected. And there's another really sort of dark side of the history of milk, and that is what's called swill milk. Mm. And swill milk is milk produced by cows that are fed the byproduct of distilleries, when the distilleries distill the grain, and they have all of this mush grain, and they feed it to the cows, which become sickly and produce a very inferior milk. But it was a little extra money for the people who own distilleries in cities, and it was a way to get people in cities milk from the city rather than having to transport it from the countryside, mm-hmm. which before refrigeration, you can imagine, was pretty precarious. So swill milk was probably responsible for a lot of infant mortality. It was often, because it was not high quality, it was carried germs and disease. It also was sometimes diluted with water to make it spread, you know, for adding profit, and then sort of thickened with chalk or plaster of Paris and all sorts of adulterants, which were very dangerous. But people in the cities were feeding their infants milk, and they felt that they didn't have much of a choice sometimes. So then when pasteurization comes on the scene, turn of the century, which was compelled in part by the swill milk scandals. Milk becomes much safer, but really the boost in milk drinking is when we discover vitamins. And milk is really the first sort of protective food that's discovered. And it's discovered that if you drink milk, you're not going to get certain deficiency diseases that people were, you know, really concerned about and was an issue in the United States.
And how about orange juice? When did that get added to the American breakfast?
Very shortly after milk. and that was also thanks to discoveries of vitamins. And when vitamin C was discovered to be in orange juice, the fruit growers associations really jumped on the bandwagon and marketed it as a health food and or drink. And not just as something, you know, in general to keep you healthy and give you strength and vitality, but to prevent all sorts of things, acidosis, you know, bad breath, whatever. And then during the war, World War II, the military looks at the orange groves really as vitamin factories, and they try to figure out how can we get orange juice to the troops and can't send it fresh, and so they create a powdered orange juice. But it's not really that appealing. The soldiers stomach it, but when it goes on the market after World War II, Americans are not really willing to drink it, and it's a flop.
Are we talking Tang here?
I don't know, because I certainly didn't taste it. I think what happened was John Fox, whose invention was associated with Minute Maid and the Minute Maid Corporation, basically found a way to, using a sort of a vacuum mechanism, to dehydrate the orange juice so that it was still, I think, I can't remember the proportions. In other words, to create the concentrate that we have today as frozen orange juice, and that tasted a lot more like fresh orange juice. And because of the health claims, orange juice became a big hit very, very quickly after the war.
We have a comment from Dan from Malvern. Can she discuss the origin of rolled oats for breakfast? Can you do that?
Well, sure. People were eating stewed grain, I mean, back in England before colonists came to the United States, not just for breakfast, but it was particularly popular for breakfast, whether it was barley, whether it was wheat, whether it was oats, or in the United States or the colonies, corn. But some of these, if you had a flour, you could make it fairly quickly. So a sort of a cornmeal mush was known as hasty pudding because it was hasty. It didn't take too long to make. Oats did take a little bit longer, and it was the Quaker Oats, a company in the 1870s that invented a way of, you know, processing the oats, so it didn't take quite as long. And that was not only a health food, but it was convenient. And Quaker Oats, by the way, is the first product to benefit from packaging, from cardboard, not just packaging, but cardboard packaging. And so the cardboard packaging offers a very interesting opportunity for the company to advertise its product. And since you weren't going and buying oats from the miller, you were buying it maybe from the grocery store and taking it off the shelf, the imagery and the copy on that packaging is what assured you that it was high quality. And I love really the story behind the logo on Quaker Oats, which is, you know, that Benjamin Franklin Quaker.
I do indeed.
Man, and he's holding a scroll and it says pure. And this was very important because, as you know from what I just shared about swill milk, I mean, a lot of food was adulterated. And even if it wasn't intentionally adulterated, it was subject to contamination because people bought it out of barrels and jars and it was exposed to the air and the dust and many hands. But when you had something in a package, it was a different story. And so Quaker Oats really innovates that, and breakfast cereals quickly follow.
Well, speaking of advertising, this is a commercial from, I think it's about 1950 for Kellogg's cereal. And let's give it a listen.
Hey, did you see what I see standing in a row? Kellogg's bright new faces on the All-Star Breakfast Show.
Cornflakes, the leader, is here with a bright new face, a colorful ear of corn.
Golden corn.
Rice Krispies with fruit on top sing a kind of cereal bop.
Snap, crackle, and pop.
Pep shows what parents prize, boys and girls with sparkling eyes.
Sugar corn pops, good and sweet, bring cowboy stars you'll like to meet.
Seven more, each a treat, make the cast complete.
On the All-Star Breakfast Show.
I'm just laughing.
That's
there. Cute. Isn't that cute? I'm looking at our engineer here. We're laughing our heads off. It's just amazing that a commercial like that was effective. But it's, you know, it's very jolly, and you get the names of the cereals, and obviously everyone's very excited about Kellogg's.
And they're clearly interested in selling to children at this point. I mean, they're not necessarily advertising to children. Shows up a little bit later, I think, en masse. But a lot of these products appealed to children or were, you know, advertised to parents as appealing to children.
Let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. We're getting a short history of the American breakfast with our guest, Abigail Carroll, author of a book called Three Squares. Again, 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Bob from Cherry Hill to join us. Bob, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi there. Go ahead.
Very quickly, there's a European, European idea that you eat like a rich man for breakfast and a little bit at lunch and a pauper at evening time. And it seems we've inverted that in this country. And also on the topic, the difference between people retiring have more time for breakfast than people who are working.
Fair enough, Bob. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Abigail, one of our earlier guests talked about the fact that most or a lot of people today for breakfast just kind of grab something and go. And the thought of sitting down and eating a bowl of cereal just seems like a gigantic waste of time. But what about this idea of you eat like a rich man and then a pauper for dinner?
You know, I think what shapes our meals more than anything, more than taste, is work. In our country, work is very important to us in this country. We're a country in many ways founded on work. And our meals accommodate that and they reflect that. And breakfast is a great example of that. We have tailored breakfast to serve our work needs, really. And getting off early, not spending time cooking, not spending time cleaning, and not spending time digesting, really, because you're eating something so light. And so not only does it make it easier to get out the door quickly, but it doesn't cause you to lag or feel lethargic, and it makes you more efficient at your work. And that shows up in rhetoric about lunch as well, when it becomes, you know, important to eat a not too substantial lunch, you know, have a sandwich, not a sit down dinner at lunch. And so I think it's interesting that breakfast cereal is now becoming replaced by breakfast bars because it's more convenient, when in fact breakfast cereal was incredibly convenient, you know, when it starts showing up. And in fact, John Harvey Kellogg, who was a medical student, he really developed it for the health of his patients. But he also, you know, being very pressured by his studies, living in a very small apartment, I think in New York, with very, very little space in terms of kitchen amenities, was kind of dreaming already of a way to basically serve stewed grains, which a lot of people were eating for breakfast, in a way that they didn't require them to, you know, spend 40 minutes stewing it on the stove and then cleaning up afterwards.
I want to just throw one more thing in before we have to say goodbye. You also write that sugar was added to prevent spoilage. Can you give just a quick explanation why?
You know, I don't know the science behind that, but I know that corn flakes, the corn oil in the corn flakes was causing there to be a sort of premature spoilage. And the Kellogg brothers were looking for ways to give their product a little bit of a shelf life. And it was kind of a scandalous story because, you know, sugar, like meat and like coffee and certain other things, was really taboo in the eyes of many of these reformers. And John Harvey Kellogg was a Seventh-day Adventist, and it was just not part of the acceptable diet for his faith. But his brother, Will Keith, who collaborated with him, was less interested in the health of the sanitarium patients and more interested in making money. And so for him, the compromise was not too big of a compromise to make. And sure enough, they split over it, sugar won out, and I think maybe one of the vehicles with which Kellogg's Corn Flakes, you know, made its way to fame.
Well, on that note, Abigail Carroll, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you very much, Marty.
You're welcome. She's a food historian, author of a book called Three Squares, The Invention of the American Meal. We called her up to join us to talk about breakfast. Also spoke with Matthew Hudak, who does research on the changing American breakfast. And we began with Eric Rim about how to eat a healthy breakfast. Go to WHYY.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program, including podcasts and Facebook, Twitter. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. We have assistance today from Ariel Plotnick, our intern this summer. And the show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.